my advisor, so I should make sure to thank him twice, perhaps.
Okay,
so what am I talking about today? I'm talking about some product theory in finite fields, right? And that can mean a lot of different things. There's a lot of different problems. Okay, so what is perhaps the classical setup of the problem is that if we have A to be a finite subset of the integers, okay, or a ring in general, okay, if you consider the sum set A plus A, which is just the set formed by taking addition of all the elements of A, and the product set, which is formed by taking the product of all the, well, of all the elements of A, okay, then the central question is whether or not the size of A plus A and the size of A dot A, well, whether they can both be small at the same time, essentially, right, for the same set, whether they can both can be small, okay. What were essentially the motivating examples here? Right, if you take A to be, well, the 1 through N, right, or really any arithmetic progression, okay, any arithmetic progression, then if you look at the sum set, you'll see that it's approximately of size A. But if you look at its product set, then it's approximately of size A squared. Okay. However, if you look at if A is, well, the specific, right, geometric progression, but any geometric progression in general, then you'll see that the sum set is about the size A squared, or approximately size of A squared, whereas the sum set is, product set is about the size of A, the sum set is about the size of A squared. Okay. So essentially the question is there anything in between a geometric progression and arithmetic progression? Okay. And in the early 80s, Erdős and Zimmerman, right, made a conjecture that essentially said no. Okay. Specifically that either the sum set or the product set are pretty much one or the other, right, is essentially of size A squared minus epsilon, right? Pretty much the whole ball game, right? Can't really get below that. So essentially there's no sets in this context that behave, they either behave like a geometric progression or an arithmetic progression. Okay. And you really can't get away from that. Okay. Well, Erdős and Zimmerman, in fact, right, not only made the conjecture, but they got the first positive result where they had, instead, here they had a 1 plus epsilon, where epsilon was a very small number, right, that I don't remember the exact exponent. Okay. Then there was a considerable amount of work on the problem. For any epsilon, though, I mean, you can kind of talk about what that, you know, that epsilon could actually be some sort of logarithmic term or something like this, right? Right. So it's not completely clear, right, exactly what that epsilon should be. Okay. Right. There was a lot of work done on this by a few breakthroughs by Nathan and Ford, right? In the late 90s, Elikesh used an argument based on the Zimmerman-Trotter-Enson's theorem, okay? And a rather elegant argument, because it's going to be written down in 3 or 4 lines, right, to get to 5-fourths, okay, which was the best known until a few years ago. So Moshe, right, elaborated on this argument, right, to get to this A to the 14 over 11 minus epsilon, okay, which is the best known until today. Okay. So this is the classical problem. Okay. A few years ago, the finite field case was explored, right, groundbreaking work by Borgan, Katz, and Tao. Okay. And the theorem that they proved specifically was A is a subset of a ZP, where P is a prime, okay, and A is of size between P to the 1 minus epsilon and P to the epsilon for some epsilon, and there exists a delta, right, there exists some delta, such that the max of A plus A, A dot A, is greater than A to the 1 plus delta. Okay. So, and not too long after that, actually, this assumption P to the epsilon at the bottom was removed by Glivicek, Borgan, and Kunyagin, I believe, was on that paper, right? They actually removed this assumption, so this isn't necessary. Okay. Delta? It depends on epsilon, I guess, and the size of A. All right. Okay. Well, it depends on, let's see. I mean, it depends on just the size of A, I would think. Right? Not, yeah, it wouldn't. I mean, our sets are essentially arbitrary, so we really don't want to talk about the actual structure of the set in any way. Okay. Okay. So this result was a very nice result, right, based on combinatorial techniques. Okay. However, right, the precise relationship between epsilon and delta, right, was not determined. So about a year and a half ago, Alec Disovich, myself, and Joseph Solimoshi, we used essentially some Fourier analytic techniques / character sums, if you're a number theorist, right, to give a kind of precise, right, a more explicit bound, right, on the sum set and the product set. Specifically, that in a large range, right, means that if size of A is greater than, I believe, if I remember right, 7/10, then this bound holds, right, and from 1/2 to 7/10, this bound holds, right. So it's actually, we only get things in the upper range, and that's for a specific reason, which we'll talk about in a second. Now, this result was rather nice, at least I thought. It hinged upon using some rather non-trivial number theory estimates for twisted Clustermann sums. Okay. But at this point, this is essentially old news. Okay. This has actually been generalized, right, and improved several times since then. Okay. For these large subsets, essentially, meaning that if A is greater than Q to the 1/2, then the current best result is that either the sum set or the product set is bigger than this, right? This is will hold in the upper range where A is greater than Q to the 2/3, okay? And this will hold in the range 1/2 to 2/3. The nice thing about this result is this is actually sharp. This top in the top range, this is sharp. Now, this kind of begs the question as why I'm talking about things all greater than Q to the 1/2, because at this point I'm talking about things in arbitrary finite fields. Of course, we can't do anything, well, at least at 1/2, Q to the 1/2, because there's existence of subfields, and of course you'll get a trivial result at that point. Okay. However, if you restrict the case to prime fields, as the original Borgan-Katz-Tau paper did, of course, then you can get results. And Grive actually got the first results, or explicit bound results, right? Last winter, and since then it's been improved slightly. Katzenshin modified the technique just a little bit, right, to improve. I believe Garayev had 15 over 14 here, and they improved this to 14 over 13. Okay, but for the purpose of this talk, I'll be talking about essentially the arbitrary finite field problem, right, and whereas the problem is not completely understood, right, how it's different, and of course it is different, right, in prime fields. Okay, so onto a related problem. So a related problem, well, this sum product basis in finite fields, this is kind of a terminology. It's not quite very popular yet. It's Glibacek's terminology. Essentially, the question is that since we have this rather robust relationship between sums and products, right, since that one or the other has to be large, which is something that, right, doesn't happen in general, okay, if you just consider, say, the sum set or product set, right, or a sequence of sums, I guess, or a sequence of products, right, of course, it doesn't have to be large. But the question is that since the sum set and the product set, one of them has to be large, and then since you tie the operations together, okay, if you tie the operations together and you just let A be a large but arbitrary set, then you actually get the whole field, okay, or at least most of the field, as we'll see in a second. Okay. So a lot of results, various results, have been gotten in the last few years, right? Borgan, Krut, Glibacek, Punyagin, Skredov, Tau Vu, and many others have essentially done in this problem in various, right, interpretations of the problem. Sometimes it's not explicitly stated, but this is the problem being studied. Okay. But just actually a few weeks ago, right, the problem is essentially solved by Glibacek for D greater than or equal to 8. Okay. And it was extending results of earlier results of Glibacek and Punyagin for prime fields, where he says that if A is a subset of FQ star, the star there, the fact we're dealing with a multiplicative group is really unimportant. It's just for technical reasons. Okay, that if A is greater than Q square root of 2 times Q to the 1/2, right, then you actually get the whole field for 8 A squared. So essentially, you can stop at 8 because this is a sharp result up to this constant square root of 2, right, for the subfield. And various others, actually, there's even in prime fields, there's examples of why this would be sharp up to this constant square root of 2. Okay. So then the question can be begged, right, what about when D is small? Right, because while those results are done with combinatorial techniques, right, in fact, give us sharp bounds or sharp results when D is large. When D is small, right, the question is essentially, you know, the results can't give you anything. And so
the first, well, explicitly stated result for this problem, right, was when D was equal to 3, Borghan used one-dimensional exponential sums methods, right, and if Q is a prime, though I'm sure it can be lifted, right, for Q arbitrary, and A is a subset of Q star, then he gets the following bound, right, that FQ is equal to dA squared if A is greater than Q to the 1/2 plus this 1 over 2 D minus 1, right, this term, right, this is kind of your error, how far you're away from conjecture. Okay. Right, and yeah, this he actually only proved this in D equals 3, though. Now, the argument lifts directly, right? If you want, you can iterate it and get it for all D, and things get a little bit better. Okay. Now, the key is here that Borghan studied this using a one-dimensional exponential sums, and when you write down the problem that way, you'll see that it's very natural just essentially to take an absolute value inside of the, when you expand these things in the frequency domain, right? Use your character sums or Fourier analytic techniques. It's just very natural to take an absolute value inside, right? And but immediately upon doing that, you actually kill some cancellation. Okay. And so just, I don't know, 6 months ago, 6 months ago or so, myself and Alex Yusevich, right, we proved a stronger result, is that if A is a subset of FQ star, then actually we can get, well, we can't quite get all of FQ. There's another technical reason for that, right? We can't quite get all of FQ, but we can get dA squared if A is greater than Q to the 1/2 plus 1 over 2D, right? All right? And this is essentially one better, right? Because the point is this result actually gives nothing if D is 2. Right? Borghan's result gives nothing if D is 2. Okay? Says you have to take the whole field. Okay. However, right, this result does give you something. It actually gives you Q to the 3/4 if D is equal to 2, right? Up to this fact that we can't quite get the zero element. No, it's just a small bit of additive structure you need to throw in here if you want to get the multiplicative element. And not only that, we proved this positive proportion type result, right, which says essentially that we could loosen this a little bit more, okay, or considerably more, right? If we take d equals 2, then this changes to the exponent 2/3 as opposed to 3/4, right, and then we could actually get half the elements. Okay. Now, if you want more of the elements, you can actually change this constant to be higher here, and you can get actually more elements of the field as well. Okay. So essentially, how did we go about doing this? Well, since we're harmonic analysts, we took a kind of a geometric measure theory point of view. Right? We translated the problem into a multidimensional problem, okay, actually talking about we took FQD to be the d-dimensional vector space over FQ, right? And then we defined a set of dot products. Well, to be the set of dot products, it's all possible dot products formed by X and Y, where E is a subset of FQD, right? So we form the set of dot products by looking at all the dot products formed by X and Y and E. Okay? Okay. And then you can probably already see why this is actually a similar type problem. Of course, you know, it is, in some sense, a harder problem, okay, because we're not assuming any product structure on the set. Okay? And so we ask the question in this context, how large does E need to be sure that the dot product set of E is large? Similar question. It actually implies the previous one. Okay. And our main results in this case were the fact that EFQD, E is a subset of FQD, then if E is of size greater, strictly greater than Q to the D plus 1 over 2, okay, then we can actually get the dot product set to contain FQ star. Okay. And if specifically if E is a product set, right, like A cross A times A times A cross A, I mean, depending on how we want to look at it, okay, then we can actually get this positive proportion result, right, with a slightly better exponent, right? And this is the exponent that matches the positive proportion result for the arithmetic result. Okay. And of course, then if we take E to be A times A times A, right, up D times, right, then you can see that, right, this is actually the same result, right, because if you're counting dot products and you take this to be your product set, well, if E is of size, then of size A to the D, right, you divide through by D and you get the result that we stated for FQ star. And here, if you divide through by D, you'll see that you'll get that same exponent we got for the positive proportion result. So how did we go about proving this? Well, we said we took a geometric measure theory approach, right? We defined an incidence function. Okay? We defined an incidence function. And we looked at its incidence function essentially just counts the number of times a single dot product, right, occurs for X and Y. And, of course, then you can immediately rewrite it, right? counting the number of dot products as a sum, where I use E of x here, right, this is probably different than most people have used today, though. E of x here is just the characteristic function of the set, okay, indicator function of the set. Okay, so this is just rewriting, but then we can rewrite this again, okay, as the sum of E of x times, well, let's just go ahead and skip a line, right, R E of x, where R E of x is this operator, right, which we is a discrete analog, right, of the radon transform V, at least in finite fields, right. Okay. So we've kind of, this is just an immediate transformation. I mean, this is just a rephrasing of the problem, in fact. Okay. So why do we expect that this might be helpful? Okay. Because in the Euclidean setting, well, we take this version of the radon transform, then we see that, right, that we actually, it's well known, right, that this gains d minus 1 over 2 derivatives on L2. Okay. And so what we actually want to do is essentially find a suitable analog for this in the finite field case. Okay. So using the radon transform, we get these incidence bound estimates. Okay. So how do we do this? Well, pretty standard techniques, right? You take this nu of t, it's a sum, you expand out with orthogonality, right, move to the frequency domain, and then you extract the mean. Okay. We extract the mean, and then we have this remainder term. And then using whatever techniques we can, right, we show that this remainder term is small. Okay. Now, how is this going to imply our final result? Well, okay, well, we have that R of t is bound in absolute value by this term, okay, and we have this mean term. Well, if this mean term is bigger than this bound, well, of course, the nu of t is positive. And positive for every t, right? I'm not specifying a specific t. Well, of course, if it's positive for every t, then for every t, right, this nu of t is greater than zero when you get all of fq. Or fq star, in fact, because this actually didn't write this in here, but this only holds for t not equal to zero. Okay. Furthermore, right, I didn't have time to put in the proof here, but of course, when you see that actually the estimation of r of t, right, you see some terms that in general can't be improved, okay? But that might be improved if you looked at things on average, okay? So we have approached it with an L2 type estimate averaging, right? And again, then you apply the same types of techniques where you move to the frequency domain. Well, maybe you do some Cauchy-Schwarz tricks first, of course, and then you extract out a mean, okay? And then at that point, you, well, do some calculations, and you get this funny quantity where, let's make sure I have everything defined, where we get the sum of E hat squared, right, which is great, right, spectacular, and this other term, which is actually E intersected with a line, right, generated by K, essentially slope K, right, K is the point down here, and so of course this is nice because E intersection with LK, well, at most, I mean, regardless what E is, it could be no more than the size of the line, which is size Q. But if, in fact, if we notice that if we take E to be a product set, okay, then of course, right, you can only collect as much as the size of A. Okay. And then once you have this bound, well, it's just, you know, standard, you know, L1, L2 trick, you know, where you do Cauchy-Schwarz to get the support to actually be able to get the positive proportion result. Okay. So open question. Sparlinski, not too long ago, I guess this last summer, right, noticed that you could actually, with a positive proportion result, you didn't need quite as much as what we had, right? Because we have things like A dot A plus A dot A, right? And in the case D equals 2, though this is, of course, you could take this to higher D as well, right, that you could actually get the same positive proportion result, A dot A, with just A dot A plus A, right? Same exponent, same positive proportion result. And so the open question then is the question that I'm trying to answer and have asked many people, is the fact is whether or not, right, whether or not we can actually get this, the whole field at least minus the zero element, right, for A dot A plus A for any epsilon. Because in some sense, well, you can see, right, at least as best as I can do, right, this is where the Fourier analytic techniques, they break down, and I can only get, of course, with epsilon equal to zero. Okay. So the question is still open, right, whether for any epsilon here, right, whether it's, you know, 1 over a millionth, right, whether or not you can actually get all of FQ star. And I can't find any counterexample to it. Okay, and why do I think this is interesting? Well, of course, because if you take A to be anything that's not like a subgroup, a multiplicative subgroup. Then this, where the size of A dot A is, say, greater than A to the size of A to the 1 plus epsilon, then, of course, it's trivial that you get this result. And, of course, then if you take A to be exactly a multiplicative subgroup, well, we already know this from our previous results, right? We can actually get this with Q to the 3/4 just by the fact that this, you know, A dot A plus A dot A collapses down into, well, to A dot A plus A. So we know in both these two extreme cases, but it's still, I still can't find a way to be able to, you kind of, in a sense, get in between, right? For things that are kind of like multiplicative subgroups but aren't, right? They have this small doubling, but they're not multiplicative subgroups.